Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to explore fermenting, preserving, and all those DIY things that people are really hot for right now.
And there's a little surprise to end the program.
Right.
We'll keep that a secret till the end.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
It will be fun. There's even a performance. It's just not ours.
Thank God.
Anyway, here we go with a wonderful lady who goes by the name of Mrs. Wheelbarrow.
Oh, she's Kathy. She's wonderful.
I think that when you hear the interview, you'll understand that.
Kathy Barrow is actually one of my Twitter buddies, and she's written a book. Her name, of course, is obvious. She's Mrs. Wheelbarrow, an obvious name. And the book is Mrs. Wheelbarrow's Practical Pantry, Recipes and Techniques for Year-Round Preserving. And, Kathy, I just want to congratulate you on an absolutely beautiful, beautiful book.
Thank you so much.
Photography is enough to make everyone start preserving.
From the very beginning, I told the two photographers, Christopher Hersheimer and Melissa Hamilton from Canal House, that I wanted it to look as though we had just picked that fruit up at the farmer's market and set it on the kitchen counter. And for the most part, that is what we did. We shot for 5 consecutive months shooting the food that was as fresh as could be for that particular month. It was grown locally. It was shot locally. And then we would eat it. It was perfect.
Right. We interviewed them about their book when they wrote it. And that sounded like a fun adventure, Canal House.
Yeah.
But these glisten like jewels in this book. They're just wonderful. I said to you before we went on the recording here, I think it's important at the outset to explain what this book is and what it isn't. I mean, you pointed out it is not anything having to do with fermentation.
Well, I think that there's a different question here altogether. This is a book on many forms of preserving.
Right.
Water bath canning, pressure canning, curing meat, smoking meat, brining meat, and that includes fish as well, and all kinds of fresh cheese making. That's not to say that fermenting, dehydrating, and freezing aren't part of the whole preservation family. But for this book, what I chose to do was focus on water bath canning, pressure canning, curing meat and fish, and making cheese, and then recipes using those things that you've preserved.
Which, I mean, my first question looking just reading the intro to the book was, I don't know how many people you're feeding, but we would never be able to get through all the stuff you preserve.
Oh, you'd be surprised. There's only 2 of us at home. I do entertain quite a bit, and I give a lot of jars as gifts.
Yes.
I haven't purchased a gift in years because all anybody ever wants is something that I've put up. So I do a lot of preserving. My batches are small, 3, 4, 5 small jars of jam or 6 jars of tomatoes at a time, and that's pretty easy to use up, even in a family of just 2.
You said that your food costs overall even out because you only use the best organic.
My food costs even out because I do a lot of preserving and purchasing all summer,
uh-huh.
And then I use that food all winter. My right. grocery bills in the winter are very small.
Right, but you do put out the money in the spring and summer.
I do.
Oh, yeah. Did this answer your question, Peter, about the...
I asked Kathy before she came on the air, because we've had several people talk to us about fermentation, and I guess if I can summarize what Kathy just told us, fermenting is a way of preserving, but there are many other ways of preserving, fermentation included, but fermentation isn't included in this particular book. And I'm sure
I think that Sandra Katz, who wrote Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation, is really the go-to guy for fermenting.
Exactly. So many people are doing this anymore. It's just amazing, huh?
Yes, it's really a big culture of do-it-yourselfers out there for many reasons. Partly because they want to control what they're eating and what goes into the recipes that they make. Partly, like me, to support the local food industry, become closer to the farmers and the producers locally, and because it's delicious. Let's just not forget that. the most important reason to preserve your food is that it's delicious.
Now, let's just take it from the perspective of somebody who really knew very little about this. And the only thing I know about the first method, what is the first method called again?
Water bath canning.
Water bath canning is that my stepfather once made a very strategic error. My mother used to make jam and marmalade.
And
she always complained about the problem of boiling the water for the jars to make sure they were really clean and sterile and all that kind of stuff. So she had a birthday coming up, so he bought her a very large vessel called a jam pan. And he gave it to her for her birthday, and he almost wore it.
Yeah.
She was totally outraged that he would be so thoughtless as to give her a useful gift for her birthday.
Oh, I'd be thrilled.
So forever after in our family, if you give someone a not appropriately considered gift, it's called a jam pan.
That's funny.
One thing that
is true now that probably wasn't true then is that the regulations for sanitizing jars has changed. It's no longer considered necessary to boil the jars for any recipe that will be processed for 10 minutes or more.
Yeah, I read
that. That includes almost all recipes, with the exception of juice and jelly.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I mean, I'm talking more than 60 years ago was when this singular event took place.
This has made the whole process so much more streamlined. It doesn't require as many pots and pans. It's much, much easier.
Yeah, you have a list of old-fashioned ways of doing preserving. They're no longer acceptable. What are some of those?
Oh, open water canning, which is one version, using the oven, turning the jars upside down, paraffin wax, all of that is just not, that just doesn't happen anymore.
Well, I mean, I still remember the grape jelly with the paraffin wax on it that my mother
made.
Well,
that's how I learned.
Yeah, and I also remember the open pot boiling and the open jar boiling.
I think people sort of know about that one. Now, the pressure version, your second group, was entirely new to me. You know about pressure cookers. We had one. We really never used it because we were a little frightened of it, and we finished up giving it away.
Well, pressure cooking and pressure canning are two different processes.
Sure.
The pressure canner is a very large and heavy piece of equipment, and I call it graduate school in the art of canning.
Okay.
Because you really do have to take it seriously. It is science. But it's not, there's never going to be an explosion where the whole thing is going, you know, the top's going to fly off. That just doesn't happen if you're using the equipment properly. So the pressure canner, the beauty of it, is that it raises the internal temperature of the food inside those jars.
Yep.
To 241 degrees. And that's the temperature at which botulism dies. And what that means is that using the pressure canner allows us to begin to preserve foods that would not be safe in a boiling water situation. And that includes things like meat and fish. And that's where things became so much more useful for me. When I could start canning soups and stock and dried beans and fresh beans, and several things. Duck confit, of course, is one of my favorites, and tuna in oil. But really, for everyday use, to be able to put my chicken stock on the shelf instead of the freezer made a huge difference.
Oh, it does, yeah. You don't have to thaw it, right?
Now stay with that subject for a second longer for me, if you would, because I noticed one page, it's like 220-something, where you have a little sidebar, if you like, that says do not can.
Yes.
Tell us about some of those things.
Yeah, they surprised me, actually.
Well, you should never can any dairy or any grains. So forget putting oatmeal in a jar.
Well, what about noodles? I mean, what's
no,
wrong with
no
noodles?
Noodles. Absolutely not.
So you can't make chicken noodle soup.
You can make chicken soup, and then you can add the noodles later.
Now, why is
and that's what I do. I make a turkey soup, and I'm happy to put noodles or rice in it after, barley. All of those grains just get added after the fact.
Now, why is that? Is there a short answer?
Because it's unsafe.
Okay. Well, we certainly don't want to do that.
That's the safest answer I can give you.
Okay.
There's so many things. You're really very adamant about following the measurements, the directions to a T, because there are things that can really harm you as a result of home.
But there are a lot of things that are easy to make and shouldn't make anyone nervous. Jams, pickles, and jellies. Really, nothing can go wrong there. It's a high acid, low pH food. The worst thing that would ever happen is you'd get mold in the jar and you'd see it and you'd know. But I am adamant, you should always follow the rules here. This isn't cooking, it's science. And if you're the kind of cook who finds it absolutely impossible to follow a recipe, you probably aren't cut out for canning.
Right, even if you get this book and hit yourself over the head with it frequently. although you could do yourself some fairly permanent harm, or at least you'd get your own attention.
It's a pretty big book.
It's a big
heavy book. Now, I loved quickles.
Quickles, yes.
Thank you.
Explain quickles.
A quickle is a quick pickle. And the most familiar quickle is probably that pickled red onion tangle that's often on top of a taco. Those just take 20 minutes to make.
Wow.
A quickle uses a brine that's half water, half vinegar, a little salt, a little sugar, and some spices. And that's all you need. You can cut up your vegetables, put them in that brine, and depending on the vegetable and how dense they are, they'll be ready in either 20 minutes or a couple of days.
Now, you have to be careful with something about cucumbers. Had me very confused because there's an end that has a flower on it. I knew that cucumbers had two ends. That's fairly obvious. I didn't realize other than that they were structurally different.
Oh, yes.
Yes, one end is, if you watch a cucumber grow,
I never did. I don't really like cucumbers very much, so I never paid any attention.
Well, you used to watch them in my mother's garden.
One end of the cucumber, the blossom end, contains an enzyme. And if you don't cut that end off, it will make your pickles mushy. So I just tell people to cut both ends off because it's too hard to know.
Now, the other thing that startled me was that you should use, I guess, you don't use tap water because it has chlorine in it, and that's another part of the chemical nightmare.
Well, the only thing that will happen is that you'll get a chlorinated taste in your pickle, which is really unpleasant.
Right. Well, you said that it's a gas and it'll disperse over time, so you just set the water out. But that then doesn't get rid of the fluorides and the base metals and all the other garbage that's in your water, your tap water. So you recommend filtered water, right?
I do. I prefer to use filtered water. But if that's impossible, the one thing you want to make sure you do is leave the water out overnight just to let the chlorine gases disperse from the water before you make a pickle.
Yeah, well, I think people around the country will have different levels of difficulty with this depending on their city water supply. Yeah. One of the fascinating things about the book is when you said that you just got caught up in the actual preserving and canning process until you couldn't even give away enough because you had so much in your pantry. And that's when you turned to making recipes using the pantry ingredients, the canned ingredients. And you have some really interesting recipes for that. Tell us about some of those.
I try to use, let's just think about jam, for instance. I do make quite a few flavors of jam, and while the quantities are small, 3 or 4 jars per, I still will find sometimes toward the end of the winter, I have quite a few jars of jam left. I like to use it for pan sauces for almost any kind of meat. A little bit of jam, maybe some mustard, maybe some soy sauce, all those things will make a beautiful pan sauce. I use jam in my barbecue sauce. I layer it on a focaccia with caramelized onions.
Oh, I saw that. That looked absolutely luscious.
It's delicious, and it's a great dish almost any time of the day. And then if we move into pickles, I use the brine in pickles to brine chicken breasts before I cook them.
Yes.
It's the easiest thing in the world. You just pour a jar of pickle brine over your chicken. And so there are recipes also for using the smoked salmon and using smoked chicken. There are recipes for using ricotta and mascarpone. So, yeah, I think there are 35 recipes altogether using the things that are preserved.
That's a really interesting part of this book, I think.
Thank you.
So you said that you were going to start exploring freezing.
I do quite a bit of freezing. There are certain things that I believe do better in the freezer than in a jar.
Like
still,
for example,
I don't. Green beans. I love a pickled green bean, dilly bean.
Yeah, I like dilly beans, too.
That's one of my favorite recipes. But I've never been able to can a green bean in a way that makes me happy. So I blanch and freeze green beans. I also blanch and freeze broccoli. Like, this year has been a tremendous year for broccoli. It's just beautiful.
Mine has never developed. It was a total mess. And on the other hand, my tomatoes were wonderful. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. But in our neck of the woods, in the mid-Atlantic, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, all the cruciferous vegetables are just incredible. I was at the DuPont Circle Farmers Market yesterday in Washington, and there was an entire table of cauliflowers that were as big as a dinner plate, maybe even bigger, in every color, purple,
oh, wow,
and red. I mean, they were just gorgeous. They're orange, not red. Purple, orange, green, and white. It was really sensational. And that kind of display will always move me to want to do something with that food. And so I brought it home and froze.
And did you blanch it? What did you do with it?
I cut it into florets and blanched it and then into an ice bath, and then I froze it on a flat sheet pan in the freezer, and then took it, you know, took those individually frozen florets and put them in a baggie.
Just as an aside here, you have a description of all the equipment you need, including some that would be nice to have but not necessary. And you come down to pretty simple assortment of what you absolutely need to start canning, and it's not much.
Right. I would say that the most important piece of equipment is probably the preserving pan. And for that, I always end up turning to my Le Creuset pots. They're so heavy on the bottom, you really can control the heat. And that is the most important part of the canning accoutrement for me.
Well, I think this is a wonderful book, and I think it's going to find it in this culture of where we're all doing it yourself anymore. It's going to find a huge audience. You're on a book tour now, and are you finding good reception?
I am. It's just been wonderful. I'm up in Toronto today. I go to New York tomorrow. I'll be in San Francisco next week and Seattle the following week. So it's a busy tour and a lot of wonderful people out there. It's so nice to meet the people who've been reading my blog. It's like meeting old friends.
Well, Kathy, I look forward to next time we exchange tweets.
Me too, Anne.
And continued success on this book, because it's a wonderful achievement.
Thank you very much.
And now that you know that preserving is preserving and fermenting is also preserving, you also know that fermenting is not necessarily preserving. Boy, it's very complicated, isn't it? But anyway, right after the break, we're going to move into the specialized world of fermentation. So specialized that two books crossed our paths recently. We decided we'd better bring them both to you at the same time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. The next thing is something that my trainer keeps trying to tell me to do. The book is called Firm Up.
Yes, very funny.
Except it's spelled differently. It's really called the Everyday Fermentation Handbook. And let's talk to Brandon Byers about how we do this. Brandon Byers, you're telling me that everything you do just about is about fermentation. You have a blog, do you? Called Firm Up. It's a weekly podcast, actually, and a blog. You ferment food at home. You have done so for years. And you collaborate with all kinds of other sites on fermentation. Now, as I said to you, we get a lot of books about fermentation. How do you differentiate your book from all these other books? And before you actually say that, I will tell you that as a result of reading this book, which you highly anthropomorphic, or is it anthropomorphic? centric or anthropomorphic centric. And so I have envision all these little tiny armies of bacteria
microbes,
and whatnot,
yeah, microbes.
Microbes, not only creating my yogurts and my cultured butters, but also I keep needing to have to feed them. So I never had that image before.
The thing right now is that fermentation is hot. A lot of people are interested in it, and a lot of people are also interested in microbes and the microbiome. And so there is plenty to cover in a book, and there are other books out there on fermentation. And really what I was trying to do with this book was give people not only ways to make different ferments and then kind of connect with those ferments on different levels, because there are actual things working and doing that stuff for us, those microbes, not only make the foods, but then know how to use them. And so the second half of the book is all about, what do I do with all these foods now that I have them? And because otherwise, traditionally, a lot of ferments are condiments or used as side dishes. And then there's some thought about, fermented foods, beaten raw, non-pasteurized, and different things like that. And I cover both because I feel that if a person has them on hand, they have them in their pantry, might as well cook with them and eat them raw and eat them any way in between. The more that people are eating them, the more likely they are to make them or just go purchase them from someone else.
That's one of the issues you start out the book with, addressing what's the advantage of eating cooked or raw. And the thing I found the most arresting about your analysis of this is that you say that actually nobody's really sure whether microorganisms may still have health benefits if they're recently deceased. Now, that's kind of an oddball approach, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. And I do state that that's more just musings and thoughts on my part, because there's a little bit of evidence to go towards many different aspects of digestion and microbes, but the science is still relatively new, and we're still discovering so much about these. And so that's where I'm if I'm going to eat the fermented foods no matter what, and again, I don't really approach fermented foods from a health standpoint much throughout the book, but I do like to put that out there just because a lot of people do. For me, it's about the deliciousness. It's about how good these things taste and how fermented foods are transformed by microbes, and whether those microbes are dead or alive. Something like bread, most people aren't eating raw bread. They're going to be cooking it, but it's still a fermented product. So some things just do better cooked.
Yeah, I love your touches, splashes of humor, actually. You said decay, it's what's for dinner.
It is, and it's delicious, and that's what people need to understand is, yeah, we're talking about a controlled decay, but decay can be delicious too.
Now, you really are heavily into the structured fermentation, which you've talked about a little bit here.
In regard to how to go about making the fermented foods?
You start out with easy fermentation, and then you move on to thought you had before about how you have to really pay attention to constantly keep fermenting things to be well-stocked with fermented foods.
Correct, yeah. That was kind of what I was hinting at. Because it is. It's one of those things where fermented foods aren't instant gratification. There are a few, some different heirloom yogurts. They can be done in 12 hours. So there are definitely things that don't take long. But many of these things traditionally come from preservation methods. So they're not looking to necessarily be things to eat right away. They're things to put up for the winter to last through an entire winter. So a lot of these flavors come out of things sitting and slowly decaying for weeks or months. And out of that comes deliciousness, but it also takes patience. So in order for people to, I feel, have these things when they want them, it is important to at least consider a little bit of structure about maybe I want to make these things, but I need to plan out a few months ahead and then make sure that I start the next batch right when this one's finished, if a person wants it.
Yes, and sometimes you reserve a bit of the one in order to get the other. Explain this, the comic cowboy space travelers of the microbial universe.
Okay, well, so that was just very anthropomorphic in the sense of just going into, diving deep into musing on microbes and looking at one way to view microbes and how they are fermenting these foods. Take these substrates. We take these different foods. I anthropomorphize it. None of these things are really happening with the microbes. There's probably not the thought or anything going on there. But at the same time, if you look at these clean substrates that we provide these vegetables, they have a certain amount of microbes on them. But once we chop it up and then put water, say for making vegetables, water and salt in there, we have the salt brine, which totally changes the environment. So imagine going to a different world. And so certain microbes, certain cowboys out in the Wild West or aliens coming to an unclaimed planet are able to then take up residency, and then sometimes there are battles. Sometimes there are things going on where one microbe starts out the process, and they create a different environment, and then a next microbe in the succession takes over, and then they can use the substrate in different ways. And so we kind of see this throughout feeding into larger organisms as well. One thing comes in, one thing another. Alcohol is another one where that's a great example of yeast will create alcohol until they can no longer survive in that alcohol, and it's that kind of that romantic death of sorts where they just no longer can live in that environment. So it's kind of just a fun way to look at some of these microbes.
You identify the main players as bacteria, yeast, and molds. Most people fear is that whatever one that they're encouraging or hope to encourage will lose the battle and the bad guy will take over.
And that is, again, another reason why I kind of went through the different successions that happened, because what it really is about creating the proper environment. Because, yeah, if you just leave taking sauerkraut, if you just take a head of cabbage and leave that out, you're not going to get sauerkraut. Like, if you just leave that on the counter, it's going to decay and it's going to start to smell eventually and going to start to look like a compost pile of sorts. That's going to take a long time, but instead, adding salt. Salt is a great way to create the environment for the lactobacilli, that the bacteria that we want, to ferment the product. And there are very few things that can live in an environment that are that salt tolerant.
Right, so, yeah, that's a good thing. That's why I trust my preserved lemons for that reason.
Exactly. Yeah, preserved lemons are a great example of something that like has so much salt in it that there's really very little, there's very even little fermentation actually going on in a preserved lemon, but it stays safe and it stays preserved, and it's kind of this enzymatic transformation that, again, turns into deliciousness over time.
A lot of people now are using this natural yeast, catching it to make bread. And
fermented properly, and it's not hard to ferment them properly, whereas meat, really need to ferment that properly, really need to make sure that you're starting with the proper environment and the proper microbe to inoculate it with, if that's the route you're going. And so that's why I stayed away from that. And I can understand why you'd stay away from that, wanting that in your basement necessarily, until you spend a lot of time researching and learning more.
I once was a guest at a dinner where the host had been making the national dish of Korea, and you indicate that stinky's okay, but let me tell you, I could barely get this stuff to my mouth. It smelled so bad. It had been in a crock for God knows how long. It was rotten. It was rotten. You know, it's like jugged hair. I told my husband he always wanted me to do jugged hair. It's rotten meat as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and that is something else I go into it with the book, is in regard to what one person considers a delicacy,
yes,
another can think is completely gross. And a lot of that is a cultural context, what someone, the environment someone's brought up in, and also an acquired taste. Another fermented product that people don't often think of is coffee. Most kids and children don't generally enjoy the taste of coffee,
bitter,
but plenty of adults.
Now, you have a list of equipment, and I must say, as I said, I've interviewed a number of people about fermentation, and you have things listed I never knew existed in terms of equipment, like the one that had me really... airlocks. I never knew there was such a thing as an airlock.
Yes, the airlock is very common in alcohol fermentation, and it also is very beneficial in vegetable fermentation. It's not necessary, though. For most of the ferments in the book, you don't need an airlock. Even for certain alcohol ferments, you can get away without it. But what an airlock is it's a device, and there are many forms of this device, but pretty much it allows carbon dioxide builds up in many different forms of fermentation. It allows the carbon dioxide out without allowing new oxygen in, because many of the ferments are anaerobic, so they occur without oxygen. And so oxygen is something that mold starts to grow in, so especially for vegetables, if you put an airlock, one of these little plastic devices or glass devices that have water that allow the carbon dioxide to bubble out and don't allow the oxygen back in, then mold's not going to grow on top. But again, it's not necessary, but I like to kind of give people plenty of options, because I know I like to really geek out on things, and I like to try different devices and see what works better for which circumstance. But when it comes to vegetables, I generally don't use an airlock.
Yeah, and then there's a pH meter. I mean, I don't see any reason why there shouldn't be. It's just that I never thought about it.
Yeah, and the pH meter is kind of, I say, for certain things, it's kind of just more fun and for data tracking if a person wants repeatability and to see where the ferments are and how they might change over time. The one and the main reason why I put the pH meter in there is for mozzarella. And so if anyone gets the mozzarella recipe, you might see that I give the option of doing it without a pH meter. But I've done it this way, and it's just much more guesswork. Mozzarella, in order, I guess, stepping back, in order to stretch, it needs to be at a certain pH and temperature. And so if you don't get right in that window, it's no never going to stretch. And if you so if you miss it, that's bad. So otherwise, you need to check it a lot of times. And so that's why I put that one in there. There are certain things that are very specific to a few recipes because I cover all different kinds of ferments. So I try and include the things in that section at least if someone gets lost when they're in the actual recipe. So at least they can refer back to the equipment section.
But you recommend that beginners start with fairly simple ferments, right?
Absolutely. And that's kind of the way that the book goes. I mean, it starts with vegetable fermentation, which I say is one of those things that it's really hard to screw up. So definitely recommend that people just start with that. And around this time of year, this is great. Starting into the fall, this is a great time to just ferment all kinds of produce that is in abundance now. And whether a person's grown it themselves or it's just cheaper at the market or whatnot, it's the time to make fermented vegetables. If a person consumes dairy, dairy is kind of the next step, and that's where there are plenty of things, yogurts and butter and different stuff that are very simple to make, and they don't necessarily take very long. And I get a little bit into cheese, which takes a little bit more time and commitment, but at least people can get their feet wet in that regard. But then go into things like grain fermentation and legume fermentation and a bit of beverage fermentation. So it kind of builds upon itself as to the level of commitment or newness factor that some of these ferments might have.
And let's talk a little bit about these recipes now that you used.
There was one pizza recipe
in here. Well, I couldn't picture kefir pretzels, by the way, but I'm sure they're wonderful. There was one pizza that I couldn't believe. I never thought of it. Do you put sauerkraut on a pizza or something like that?
Oh, there's the kimchi pizza.
Kimchi.
And I highly recommend sauerkraut as well. Any ferment, I mean, that's the great thing about these condiment-like fermented vegetables, and they just work so well on a pizza. And so I have a pizza, and the thing that I love about pizza, and especially like a kimchi pizza, is that it's a three-part fermentation. So you have the sourdough pizza dough, which you'll find a recipe for that in the book, and then which is going to involve microbes and involves fermentation. And then there's kimchi, obviously fermentation, fermented vegetables, Napa cabbage and ginger and garlic and a few other vegetables. And then you have cheese. So the mozzarella recipe is also in there. So I really like combining different ferments. Not that a person, if they want to make the kimchi pizza, it's not like they have to make every single thing themselves. It's not really meant to be like that. It's more so that people can, if they want to, make all three or choose to make one. Like if someone's just making the kimchi and the sourdough, then that might be all they're interested in. They might not ever be interested in making the mozzarella. But in case someone ever really wants to, that recipe's there too.
Well, I'll say one thing, and one recipe is worth the price of the whole book, is your sauerkraut pretzel grilled cheese. That sounds yums.
Yes, it's delicious. And I think, again, that's another one where there are multiple ferments in there. And sandwiches are another, I mean, pizza sandwiches, those are easy. You can start to put a lot of different ferments in those, and they're delicious. And it's a way to just remember that there are countless ways to use fermented products. And that's what I try and get people excited about.
And it's a very exciting book. Again, it's Brandon Byers. It's called The Everyday Fermentation Handbook, a real-life guide to fermenting food without losing your mind or your microbes. Very clever, Brandon. Anyhow, if I whip up one of these things, I'll let you know how it turned out.
Yes, please do. I'm always interested to hear what people, why I do the podcast. That's why I wrote this book, is really just to get people doing this kind of stuff and then write into me and tell me how these things turn out.
And just finalize it, for people who are still listening and don't want to go back to the website for your blog address, give us it now.
Sure. The best place is fermup.com. So that's FERMUP.com.
Yes, well, thank you, and keep fermenting.
Yes, happy fermentation to everyone.
Indeed.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you, Brent. Bye. Well, that's fermenting, but let's get even really more specific. Our next guests, Kristen and Christopher Schalke, actually do this, and they wrote a book about it, and that's fermenting vegetables.
But the real difference is they make a living at it, right? I mean, that's the remarkable thing, is that they become so skilled and they make so much of it that it's they're products that are very much in demand.
There's no question that fermentation and canning and brining and all of these things have taken off anew in the current generation of the United States and probably the world. I can attest that it's getting popular by just the number of books that cross my desk. And a new one here now is called Fermented Vegetables, Vegetables Plural, Creative Recipes for Fermenting 64 Vegetables and Herbs, in Krauts, kimchis, brined pickles, chutneys, relishes, and pastes.
And that's the title.
And that's the title.
you can tell it's the big book of fermentation.
And we're going to be talking to the co-writers, Kirsten Shockey and Christopher Shockey. And I want to ask first, Al, about how is this book different from the 42 other books I've gotten?
Well, as far as we know, it is the only book that really sticks to fermentation of lactic, or fermentation through lactic fermentation of vegetables. That said, there are a few fruits that are in there, but we don't go into any of the other fermented foods like milk, cheese products, or kombucha. It's just...
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I could just tell you that this is probably the most thorough and detailed of the fermentation books that we've seen.
Everything from arugula to zucchini. How about that? See, I even read all the way to the end.
Arugula?
The other thing that we wanted is there are a lot of fermentation books that say you can ferment just about anything, but we wanted to bring in the taste, the culinary side, because we both felt that a well-fermented vegetable has a beautiful, bright taste that people are missing. And so we wanted the cookbook to be beautiful and to talk about the flavors as well.
Okay.
But one of the most exciting things to me, I think, because fermentation is a cult, if you like. It's a fad almost to me. And everything fermented must be better. Now, you are honest about it, and you say, you know what, this arugula doesn't really ferment very well.
I wouldn't imagine it would.
And by the way, if you're fermenting parsnips, you better find these Japanese seeds to put in there, because otherwise it's not going to be very nice either. I think that's just a wonderful contribution to the progress of human thought, that people can actually say, you know what, not everything in the garden is rosy.
Yeah, that was really important to us. People are a little afraid of the flavor or of fermentation of the whole thing.
Yeah, I am.
We've gotten away from it, and so it was super important to us to help people understand that this food, this almost new ingredient, because we haven't been using it, can be delicious. But the only way it's going to be delicious is if you use some of the same techniques in any kind of cooking. There's things you do or don't want to put together.
Well, you know, you get so many different explanations. I ventured forth with my first fermentation effort making preserved lemons. And I must have found preserved lemons recipes in, like, maybe 6 different books. And each one had a different take on it, especially even starting with, like, whether or not you boil to sterilize the jars. Do you or don't you?
Yeah, and how long could you keep them for?
And then that was the other one. How long could you keep them for? So there's a lot of mixed advice out there.
Definitely. That's why we tried to keep it as simple as possible. But part of the reason there's such mixed advice is not everybody completely understands the process. But I think bigger than that is it's a live food and a live process. And what I do with my pickled, preserved lemons here still might be different than what happens somewhere else with a different lemon in a different place, because you're dealing with these microbes that changing all the time. But you don't need to sterilize your jar, because the process creates the acidity that doesn't allow anything that is unsafe to live.
Yeah, this is...
So that's great. And then most things you can keep refrigerated, because it's slowing down that process for a year. And some things like the pepper ferments that we've got some that are 4 years old in our refrigerator.
Ah, good for you.
And they're just still amazing, and the flavors are still changing. And that's part of why we're keeping them so long, is we really want to see, okay, what's happening here.
Now, that's not nearly as good as my Indian carrot pickle, though. I have a jar of Indian carrot pickle.
Oh, that must be 20
which,
years
which
old.
Which is in the back of the refrigerator.
I wouldn't touch it on a bed.
It's got to be at least 20 years old. It was quite a big jar. And it's not nearly full anymore, but it's still going. And I had some not too long ago. It still seems to be all right. I'm still alive, so it must be all right. But I really,
there you go.
But I had two questions for you, really. One is how. How do you become an expert on fermentation of vegetables? And then the second question, which follows right up, is why?
Well, why? Because it's so who, brilliant.
So who'd like to take how and who'd like to take why?
Well, I'll take the how, and we'll see if Kirsten can come up with a why. Because she's so the how is that we, on our homestead, we tried several other things to make the homestead pay for itself, like everyone else on a small holding. And so we made cheeses, and we milked cows and goats, which is great when you have child labor. But when the kids grow up and go to college, hopefully, then it's up to you. And Kirsten and I both love cheese, but not enough to milk wet stinky cows and goats all day. So that's one. And so then we went to hard ciders, but there's all kinds of regulations around that, and we eventually didn't do that. We went into fermentation as a business, and I think that's another thing that distinguishes us in this book from other fermentation books is that we actually had to make a living doing it, and so our recipes needed to be consistent. When people came to the market, they needed to know that they were going to get another great product, you know, a new flavor. People really liked the new flavors. So we continued to innovate around all those different vegetables, partly to attract people as the season went on, because you're competing against a fresh vegetable just across the road. And so you have to take that fresh vegetable and do something even more amazing with it to get somebody to buy it in a jar. And so that's part of the how we did it is we sourced really great organic vegetables from farms around the area, and then we added value to them and just changed the flavor profile. As to why we did it, maybe Kirsten has an idea why we did it. I'm not sure.
A lot of the why is exactly what Christopher said, is we were looking for something to do together. We enjoyed, or still enjoy, all of these wonderful preservation methods, and we love working with food. And this one, fermentation, was, as far as at least in the state of Oregon, the regulations, it was very simple because it is such a safe process. And we really liked the simplicity, so we were able to put in a certified kitchen without too much red tape. And that was a big part of the why. And then also where we live in southern Oregon, there are a lot of organic farmers on our road even, and I really am passionate about food systems and local food systems, and I like the idea of taking vegetables that maybe that year or that season they had an abundance of and being able to turn it into a product that could continue to feed people in the valley next few months, because often the farmers can't sell maybe all of the crop, and so that piece of it was really important to me, is I could go to my neighbor or they could come to me and say, hey, we have a huge crop of, you know, fill in the blank, burdock or parsnips or whatever, and can you do something with it? And that became the challenge.
That's great. That's really wonderful. I like how you sort of take turns with, like it says, Kirsten writes and then you have comments, and or Christopher writes and he has comments. I love that. It's like a real shared activity here. I just see some of these equipments I never thought you needed that you have. You've outlined everything in such detail. I don't know how you could fail, actually. But I was really surprised that you needed half this stuff.
Well, you actually, we wanted to cover all of the equipment that people could potentially use. But honestly, when we teach people how to do it in our demonstrations, all they need is a jar. They need something to cut the vegetable with, and they need salt, and they need something to weight it down. And that's all you really need. So we teach people how to do it with things that are in their kitchen. If you have a quart jar and you have a Ziploc bag, you're good to go.
Wow. Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, but as you know, as we have people now who are doing parties with other friends, and they're starting to be very proud of their creations. So then you start thinking, maybe I'll save up for a crock, you know, to have on my counter, so when people come over, I can lift the lid, and we can both peek in there and see what it's looking like. So there's a range you can go, but you really just can start out super simple and very, very inexpensively.
Oh, I was going to say, which is really important for people to understand. I know when we were at market, we got so many people that they'd made their first batch and they'd committed to, you know, a 2 or 3 gallon crock, and then something had gone wrong, and it was so defeating. Part of what we want people to take away with is that do these little bitty batches and experiment and kind of understand the process. Watch it. Keep it on your counter. Don't put it away in a closet where you can't see what's going on until you really understand it. And that's where the small jar is such a great tool.
Yeah, there's a book out. What's it called? Canning in Small Quantities, is it? Do you know about that one?
I don't.
Yeah,
but
it was really.
That's the same idea.
Yeah,
I mean that was a great book. That was the theme of the book. I'm not sure what the title was, but it said basically, you know, even if you're a single person living alone, not buying food for anybody else, you can still do your own canning and pickling and fermenting.
Yeah, even if you're in a New York kitchen, that was the.
Exactly, and that's why we put in different sized recipes to try to help people in all sizes, and then also that they can see the same recipes can be smaller or larger. You know, once they're comfortable with the process, they can say, okay, I know this is a little bit more than I want, let's scale this down, or vice versa.
Now, the other amazing thing about the book is it's like a historical almanac. With you quote from all kinds of incredible sources. I mean, you must have a big library close by. Otherwise, I don't know how you could even find all these people.
The computer, dear.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess. Get on there. Yeah, I need somebody who wrote something about asparagus because all the Romans who had something to say about asparagus are quoted on the internet. but you found someone who said it took at least 20 to 40 minutes to cook asparagus, and you quickly correct that. So even though you include the quote, you say that's really not the right answer.
I actually have that in a cookbook. That's a 18 something or another cookbook. So that one wasn't found on the internet.
Okay, there you go. It's in a real cookbook.
Well, this book is packed with so much information. It's I guess it's the ultimate fermenting vegetable book. Even if you're not going to set off fermenting right away, you get this good information such as, tell us about salt. You have not all salts are created equal. And then you have, of course, little spoons full of different kinds of salts. I mean, what do you mean by that in terms of the fermentation of vegetables?
A few things. The first is, a lot of people would come to us at the market and, you know, say their ferment was way, way too salty. And so I quickly realized as we were teaching people and talking to people that salt was, it's the other thing you need besides vegetables, and it was a big source of confusion and consternation for people. So the first thing that I felt it was important for people to understand is that kosher pickling salt, for example, says it's pure. And what that means is it's pure sodium chloride. All the other stuff has been refined out of it, maybe the trace minerals and things like that. So it's got a very salty, briny flavor. And flavor-wise, if you're using some of these other unique salts, we use a Redmond real salt in the book because that's the one that we've worked the most with. And its sodium chloride content is lower, and so it's got the trace minerals. So if you actually just taste the salt or some of these other salts, Celtic sea salt, the Himalayan salts, you'll taste that there's a sweeter flavor. And that's the first thing I thought people should understand is you can actually change the flavor of your creation and your kraut slightly and subtly by using different salt. And then the other piece to that is just understanding that coarse salt weighs a little different when you go to measure it than a fine salt, and just be aware of all of that.
Well, I mean, I think on top of all this, the information that you're providing, the technique and everything you did, you also have really interesting recipes because you seem to have opened up your curiosity to global recipes, like what are some of the ones? I mean, you have a whole bunch of them, Ethiopian this and, you know, you don't usually find that in these kind of semi-technical books. And so I think that that is something that's very valuable in your book, that people can get these global recipes. And, you know, I just think it's fun.
It's a great book to curl up with on a winter's night.
Except for if you get to the scum section at the very end, Peter, in which case, if you have nightmares.
Okay. Where's the scum section?
Yeah, I have to explain the scum section. So we took pictures. The other thing we did is this over many years, and when you have 10 gallons of something that goes slightly wrong.
Oh, dear, yes.
We documented that as well, and we took pictures of it, and we talk about it in the book because we really wanted people to know all the things that you possibly could come up with. A lot of things may look like they've ruined the batch, but they really haven't. And in other cases, it may not look somewhat benign, but it might mean it's time to throw the batch out. So
you have to do that, I know.
Absolutely, yeah. But you need to see it, too, not just hear a description of, you know, it looks like the moonscape. There's a picture in there where you really look at it and go, I could see Neil Armstrong bouncing along that. That kind of looks like the moon. And we wanted people to see that so they had a visual guide.
So they knew to throw that one out.
Yeah, but in terms of the meals, one of the reasons we had the meals is because, and this is, empirically, it's typically women, I would say, who had bought the krauts, and they would come back, and they would sort of whisper to us, you know, I'm just eating this out of the jar with a fork, but my husband thinks I'm crazy. I need to get him eating this, too. He won't eat out of the jar. What do I do? What's a good recipe? And so Kirsten has, she's a wonderful cook, and we homeschooled our kids, and we had three meals a day, every day, and she usually tried to integrate everything off the farm. So she was really good at integrating these ferments because we've been doing it ourselves for 20 years or so. And so she would start sharing recipes, and then we started printing them out and giving them, depending on what flavor we had that week, we would create some recipes for people to try. And then that became very popular, and we realized if we're going to turn people on to this flavor and teach them how to make it, we also need to teach them how to use it and incorporate it into meals. So that's how the meals part got started.
Well, I really think that's a great contribution to this whole field.
I just can't imagine what you're going to do next, but I have a feeling that a couple of years from now you're going to be back with something else you're doing on your small holding in southwestern Oregon. And thank you so much in the meantime for your contribution to the world of fermenting, and we hope the apple cider project does well too.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, good luck.
Yeah,
to your book.
Thank you.
And don't forget to stick around for the surprise after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Shall we just begin the surprise, or do you want to identify just a little bit, sweetheart?
Oh, I mean, it sort of speaks for itself. Let's just do it. When I first got the press release on this new product as a gift for the holidays, I couldn't believe what I had read, and I sent back an email saying, is this a joke? I was quickly assured that, in fact, it was not a joke.
You were somewhat reprimanded, I guess.
Yes. And directed to the website where there was a little amusing video of this particular object in action.
Don't keep us in suspense. Tell us what it is.
Okay. Well, first of all, we're talking to Heather Scott about this product called a tea carina, which, in fact, is a teacup with appropriate holes in it, And, well, you'll have to explain that, Heather. They're not actually holes through the wall of the teacups or the teaspoons. And you can actually play it as you would an ocarina. Welcome, yes. Heather.
Hi, thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, well, start out by telling us, what is an ocarina?
An ocarina is actually an ancient flute-like instrument. It goes back to the Mayans and the Aztecs. They used to make them out of animal bones and out of wood and all kinds of things. So it's actually one of the world's oldest wind instruments. So that's what an ocarina is. It's sort of like the recorder. It has a beautiful, mellow, flute-like tone. And we've turned that ocarina into a teacup that you can drink out of as well as play.
Now, my question at this point is, why?
Why not? Music is such a social activity as well as dining and having a cup of tea with your family. So we thought, why not, you know, bring music to the table, bring everyone together, and combine those two very social aspects together.
Now, before we get ourselves all lined up for lawsuits, let's make very clear what we just talked about before we came on the air. That in fact,
yes.
you don't drink tea out of an ocarina you're going to play. At least
right.
not.
So you can drink out of it as a fully functioning teacup. They're beautifully decorated, so they work as a teacup. And they also have holes, and you can play them. But we just wanted to say you probably don't want to do both at the very same time. We don't want anyone to burn themselves if they happen to spill while they're playing. But it will work with liquid in it or without.
Now, give us the website that has this demo video that's very cute.
Absolutely. So you can go to stlouisocarina.com. It's STL, as in St. Louis, ocarina, OCARINA.com. Or you could just Google Teacarina, and we'll be the first hit up there. And you can click on it, and we have a fun little video that shows a demonstration of the Teacarina, and you can hear a nice sound sample as well.
Now we're in Pittsburgh recording this interview. I'm not sure by the time it goes out over the airwaves, I'm not sure whether the Pirates will have beaten the Cardinals or vice versa. But I guess we know which side you're on, and you know which side we're on.
I am a Cardinals fan, sorry.
Well, that's okay. We're going to beat your pants off.
I'll be rooting for them.
We hope.
They usually don't disappoint, so.
Okay.
And St. Louis is the ocarina capital of the universe?
Oh, we like to think so, yeah. That's where St. Louis Ocarina is based, obviously, and we're the world's leading seller and manufacturer of ocarinas.
Now, I'm always interested in unusual factoids, especially ones that make Pittsburgh famous. So, do you know where the St. Louis Arch was made?
Well, no, but are you going to tell me Pittsburgh?
It was made in Pittsburgh. It was assembled from pieces, so they didn't actually put it all on a train at the same time, but it was
right.
actually designed by a company called Pittsburgh Des Moines Steel, which I think is still operating here in Pittsburgh. They made things out of steel.
Oh, that's very cool.
Well, let's get back to this ocarina here.
If I still had a contact there, I'd have them making stainless steel ocarinas.
Well,
we do have some. They're not steel, but we have some that have a really cool metallic kind of finish if you like that kind of look.
Yeah, well, you have a whole range of ocarinas, and they also go from the simple, which I believe are the teacups, to much more sophisticated ocarinas. You are really marketing the ones that I got the press release about as gifts, holiday gifts, right?
Yeah, the teacarinas, you could look at it in a couple ways. You could look at it just as a beautiful piece of artwork or a beautiful teacup, and you could just use it as a teacup. Or you could look at it as a great novelty gift. People are really blown away when they see this idea. They look at it and just think, oh, this is a really nice-looking teacup, but then they're done to find out it makes music, you can play it. So it's a great gift idea just for something unique and different. And also, I mean, I said it's a novelty, but you really can play sophisticated music on this if you wanted it to be a more serious instrument as well. So you can look at it in a variety of ways.
Well, we're going to do that in just a second. I just want our listeners to imagine a family playing their tikarinas together, sort of like a tikarina quartet or a, or a tikarina octet. My goodness.
Yes, isn't that a beautiful idea?
Could you also tell us before you do the demo, why is it that you can have holes in the ocarina so and the tea does not run out?
Oh, that's a great question because a lot of people are confused by that. So the teacup ocarina is it's double walled, so the instrument is like inside the teacup, if that makes sense. I think if you go to our website and look at the pictures, it makes more sense when you see one. But it's basically like we took a circular instrument and pushed it down into the shape of a teacup. So it's double walled, the liquid won't affect the pitch, and that's how the holes are in there and there's another wall behind it. So that's how the tea will not run out.
Yeah, now you are a musician, so let's have a little sample of your performing on the ocarina or the tikarina.
Yes, and this is the tikarina. It has six holes and it plays a full octave. So this is what it sounds like.
Now, what instrument do you usually play?
I started out on concert flute, which is pretty. Ocarina is actually really simple compared to that, but a lot of the fingerings are similar. Primarily, an ocarina player now, so that is my main instrument is ocarina.
Well, that was a delight, and I thank you for performing as well. And I hope this is an idea that catches on because I could see many a happy dinner party.
Yes, and I love to, I've had friends over and I've had them out and they didn't realize that they were instruments and I just started playing one and the look on people's faces when they're like, how did you do that, is just priceless. So the look on people's faces alone is worth it.
I didn't try to play one. You tried. And
I did not play. It's not as easy as
you did not.
Sound.
You did not do nearly as well as this young lady who's on the...
I'm not a musician and... I don't know that there's a simpler instrument, but I can't play this one either.
Well, Anne, I'm glad you said that. So the tikarina is it is an instrument, you know, so to be able to play a song, it does take a little practice, but all the tikarinas come with a nice little booklet, pamphlet that's got about 8 songs in there for you to learn to get you started, and it's not written as regular sheet music, so if you don't know how to read traditional sheet music, that's okay. Songs are written in picture form, so you just follow the pictures, they show you the fingering, and that's how you can kind of learn to play this unique teacup.
And you don't, I guess if you give it as a gift, you should put the tea with it as well.
Oh yeah, that would be a really great gift to make like a tea basket, put all the different flavors of tea and then the tikarinas. And you can buy the tikarinas individually, or you can get them in a set of 4. And what's really cool is you can pick and choose which 4 you want in your set. So we have a really cool line that's called the 4 Seasons Tikarinas. So we have spring, summer, autumn, winter. And they are beautifully decorated with some Asian-style paintings. And then we have some solid colors and some really cool speckled designs. And you can pick and choose any 4 that you want, if you wanted to get a set for someone for Christmas that's coming up.
Yeah, well, you've given me a great idea for a gift guide for food fanatics this year. So,
yeah, especially if you have a friend who, you know, really likes tea, and I'm a big coffee drinker. I put my coffee in them. So it's just a lot of fun. Running to the dinner table when they can drink out of one of these. So.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. Heather, I really appreciated your coming on and demonstrating it for us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you guys.
Thanks, Heather. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
After that, think about what we might bring you next week.
Well, we got to start practicing. I can't do that.
Yeah, we do. We have to work on our tikarina performances.
Exactly.
And we may bring it to you on another show, but then again, we might not. But
I would say not.
One thing's for sure, we'll look forward to seeing you in the same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.